sleep at time facts, forces. Let your body sink into the mattress. Feel the weight of the blanket resting across your shoulders, the gentle pressure of your head against the pillow. That steady downward pull is gravity, the same force that holds the moon in its slow path around the earth and keeps a cup of tea from floating off the nightstand. It never sleeps and it never hurries. It simply draws everything toward everything else, quietly and without strain. Breathe in slowly. Notice how your chest rises, a small motion against this constant attraction. As you exhale, let your muscles soften a little more. The dark around you is not empty. Gravity threads through it, linking your resting body to the floor, the house, the soil outside, all the way down to the planet's core. In the quiet of this night, that pull is a companion. It asks nothing. It only holds. Over the coming episodes, we will meet other forces, each one woven into ordinary moments. But right now, the only one you need to notice is the one cradling you where you lie. Let your breathing slow. The night is calm. Gravity is gentle. Sleep will come, a stone and a feather, dropped from the same height, reach the ground at different moments. The stone falls straight and fast. The feather drifts, hesitates, and lands softly a breath later. For most of human history, this ordinary observation was taken as proof that heavier objects fall faster. The idea feels intuitive. A cart loaded with bricks is harder to pull than an empty one. So surely gravity must tug more urgently on greater mass. The problem with that reasoning is that it mixes up two distinct things: the pull of gravity and the interference of air. Galileo Galilei, working in the late 16th and early 17th centuries, thought about the problem differently. He proposed that in the absence of air, all objects would fall together, regardless of their weight. A famous story places him atop the Leaning Tower of Pisa, dropping spheres of different masses to demonstrate the principle to a crowd. The tower leans at a gentle angle, and from its upper galleries, you can see the piazza below. Whether Galileo ever performed that public demonstration is uncertain, but he did conduct careful experiments with inclined planes. A ball rolling down a shallow slope moves more slowly than one falling straight down, which allowed him to measure motion with the tools of his time. He found that the distance traveled grew with the square of the time, meaning the ball gained speed steadily. The mass of the ball did not change that steady gain. The key insight was that gravity accelerates everything at the same rate. The force of gravity pulling on an object is larger when the object is heavier, but the object's resistance to being accelerated, its inertia, is also larger by exactly the same proportion. The two effects cancel cleanly. A boulder feels a stronger gravitational tug than a pebble, but it is harder to move by the same factor. The outcome is a shared acceleration, roughly 9.8 meters per second squared at the surface of the Earth. In a vacuum chamber on Earth, you can watch a coin and a feather tumble side by side and hit the floor at the same instant. A quiet confirmation of Galileo's reasoning. The most vivid demonstration came not from a laboratory vacuum, but from the surface of another world in 1971. During the Apollo 15 mission, Commander David Scott stood on the moon in his white suit and held a feather and a hammer before the camera. The moon has no atmosphere to speak of, so there was no air resistance to complicate things. He let go of both objects at the same moment. They fell together, a falcon feather and a heavy geology hammer, and landed in the gray dust at the same time. The image is strangely peaceful. The objects dropped slowly. Because the moon's gravity is weaker, about a sixth of Earth's, but the equality of their descent was perfect. Science became something you could see with your own eyes. A silent ballet of mass and motion. Isaac Newton later gave the phenomenon its mathematical shape. He described a universal force that pulls every particle of matter toward every other particle with a strength that depends on the masses involved and the square of the distance between them. The same law that guides an apple to the ground keeps the moon sailing around the Earth. The moon is always falling toward us, but because it has enough sideways speed, it keeps missing. The curve of its path matches the curve of the Earth beneath it. The equality of acceleration that Galileo uncovered is built into Newton's equation. The mass that determines how much force an object experiences also determines how much it resists changing its motion. They are the same number, sitting on both sides of the equation, and they cancel. In everyday life, we do not usually see this equality because air is everywhere around us. A leaf spiraling down from a tree is shaped by air resistance. Its large surface catches the breeze, slowing its fall until it reaches a steady, gentle speed. That gentle drift is beautiful, but it hides the simple rule underneath. In the stillness of a vacuum, leaf and stone would fall as one. The same patient gravity pulls on the cat stretching on the windowsill, on the raindrop sliding down the glass, and on the distant clouds that sit motionless in a blue afternoon sky. None has a special status. Each is given the same downward push, and each would accelerate in exactly the same way if the air were not there to blur the story. The Leaning Tower, the moon's feather, and the quiet vacuum chamber all point to one fact. Falling is not a contest between heavy and light. It is a shared experience governed by a single number, a steady acceleration that does not care what a thing is made of or how large it looms. When you see an apple fall from a branch, you are watching something that applies equally to moons and dust motes. The branch lets go, and gravity does the rest. The same for everyone, every time. Place your fingertip lightly on a wooden table and try to slide it forward. You will feel a gentle resistance before motion even begins. That quiet pushback is friction, a force that arises wherever two surfaces meet. It is not a single large phenomenon, but a collection of tiny interactions happening at the scale of microscopic hills and valleys. Even surfaces that look polished to the naked eye are, under magnification, rough landscapes of peaks and grooves. When those landscapes press together, the high points catch on one another. Overcoming that catching takes a small amount of force. And that is what we sense as a reluctance to slide. The earliest systematic thinking about friction comes from Leonardo da Vinci, who sketched experiments with blocks on inclined planes and noted that the resistance depends on how hard the surfaces are pressed together, not on the apparent area of contact. His notebooks lay forgotten for centuries. So the laws of friction were rediscovered later by the French physicist Guillaume Amontins in the late 1600s. Amontins stated that the friction force is proportional to the load pressing the surfaces together and independent of the size of the objects. It was a curious finding. A brick standing upright and the same brick lying flat experience the same friction when sliding on a given surface, even though the contact patch looks very different. The explanation lies in those microscopic contacts. As the load increases, more of the tiny peaks deform and make real contact. And that real contact area grows in proportion to the load. What we think of as a surface touching another is mostly empty space, with just the tips of the roughness in true connection. Rubbing your hands together on a chilly morning illustrates a second aspect of friction. It transforms movement into warmth. When surfaces slide, the microscopic junctions are repeatedly made, stretched, and broken. The work done in breaking these bonds becomes tiny vibrations throughout the material, which we perceive as heat. This conversion is not perfectly efficient, but it is reliable. People have used friction to start fires for thousands of years. Spinning a stick against a baseboard until the dust smolders in a gentler form, the same process warms your palms. A book resting on a slightly tilted surface shows how friction can hold things still. Without it, the book would slide down at the smallest incline. The force that opposes that downward tug is called static friction, and it adjusts itself up to a certain limit. Push the book lightly with one finger, and it stays put. Push harder, and it stays still. Because the peaks and valleys at the interface are deforming elastically and interlocking to resist the shear, there is a maximum value beyond which the book breaks free and begins to slide. Once it is sliding, the resistance drops a little. This difference between static and kinetic friction is why it can feel easier to keep something moving than to start it from rest. The French engineer Charles-Augustin de Coulomb refined these ideas in the 1780s, showing that the kinetic friction force is roughly constant for a given pair of materials and proportional to the normal load. Coulomb also observed that friction does not greatly depend on speed, at least for ordinary materials over moderate ranges. That is a quiet convenience. A pencil on paper, a chair sliding across a wooden floor, the sole of a shoe against pavement, all behave in fairly predictable ways. Walking itself relies on static friction between your shoe and the ground. When you push backward with your foot, the roughness of the sole and the pavement interlock, preventing your foot from slipping, and the reaction force propels you forward. On a polished frozen puddle, the interlocking is so reduced walking becomes uncertain, there is a small aid. We give friction without thinking about it. A dusty shelf can make a jar feel loose when you set it down, because the dust particles act like tiny ball bearings, reducing the interlocking, wiping the surface clean, or pressing down a little harder restores the grip. Even the gentle rub of a fingertip across a tabletop is a dialogue between the ridges of your skin and the almost invisible texture of the wood or varnish. The light vibration you feel as your finger slows is the sound of countless micro contacts forming and releasing in a soft flutter. The world without friction would be unrecognizable. But the world with friction is held in a calm, steady grip. A vase stays on its shelf. A sleeping cat stays curled on a cushion, and a spoon rests quietly beside a plate. The surfaces around us are not perfectly smooth, and that small imperfection is a gift that keeps things in their place, letting us move through the day with a quiet sense of stability. On a quiet wall, a painting hangs from a length of picture wire. The wire is looped over two small hooks and fastened at the back of the frame. It sags just a little, forming a gentle curve between the supports. Nothing moves. The picture appears to float without effort. But inside the wire, a steady force keeps everything in place. That force is tension. A silent pull that travels along cords, ropes, cables, and threads. It acts only in one way. It draws the ends of a flexible line inward, stretching the material ever so slightly. If you were to cut the wire at any point and hold both cut ends, you would feel them tugging away from each other. The pull you feel is the tension at that spot. It arises because the wire is being stretched between two anchor points, and its fibers resist being pulled apart. The picture's weight pulls downward on the wire where it attaches to the frame. In response, the two segments of wire angle upward toward the hooks. The upward components of the tension in those two segments add together to exactly balance the weight of the painting. The shallower the sag, the harder the wire must pull horizontally to produce enough upward lift. That is why picture wire is allowed to droop a little. A nearly horizontal wire would need a tremendous tension for even a modest frame. Consider a swing hanging at rest in an empty park. Two chains reach from a high bar to a flat seat. Each chain is made of many metal links. The top link feels a pull from the link below, and that link from the next, all the way down. But the tension in the chain is not the same at every height. The uppermost link must bear the weight of the seat, and also the weight of every single link that hangs beneath it. The link just above the seat, on the other hand, supports only the seat's weight and a short portion of chain. So the tension in a real chain increases steadily as you go upward, because each section carries the weight of everything below. If the chain had no mass of its own, the tension would be uniform from top to bottom. But real materials have weight, and that weight adds to the load that the upper parts must sustain. The same idea applies to long ropes. When a cable lowers a heavy instrument into the ocean from a research vessel, the uppermost meters of cable support the instrument, plus the many tons of cable that trail below. engineers account for this by making the top of the cable thicker and stronger than the deep end in a vertical rope of uniform thickness and mass. The tension at any cut is simply the weight of the rope segment below that cut plus any attached load. That straightforward rule gives engineers a way to predict the force at every point. Tension distributes itself across every fiber of a rope in a braided line. Hundreds of tiny strands lie side by side, each carrying a small fraction of the total pull. When the rope is still, the load is shared quietly among them. The fibers stretch a microscopic amount, just enough for the material's internal bonds to balance the outward pull. If one strand were weaker, its neighbors would take up a little more of the load. The rope's flexibility is what allows tension to align itself along the length of the cord, finding a straight path between the points where the force is applied. Measuring tension has a long, gentle history. Early builders tested the strength of hemp ropes by hanging stone weights until the cord parted, a silk thread thinner than a hair could, in a calm room, hold a surprisingly heavy metal bead. These simple tests revealed that a cord's capacity depends on the material and its thickness. Modern instruments, called load cells, can sense tension without breaking anything. They convert the small stretch of a metal element into an electrical signal, letting engineers read the pull in a bridge cable or an elevator rope while the structure is in use. In a large suspension bridge, the main cables hang between towers in a graceful curve under the weight of the roadway, which is distributed evenly along the horizontal span. That curve becomes a parabola rather than the catenary shape a free-hanging rope would take. The tension in those cables is not constant. Near the tops of the towers, where the cables bend over saddles, the pull reaches enormous values because the entire bridge hangs from that point. Farther out toward the center of the span, the tension is lower. Every vertical suspender cable transfers its little portion of the deck's weight upward into the main cable, adding to the cumulative pull that must be resisted by the anchorages at each end. When you see a spider's thread shining with morning dew, the strand is under a light, steady tension. It connects one twig to another, and the pull within it balances the weight of the silk itself and any tiny droplets clinging to its length. Outwardly, it appears motionless, but at every point along its length, a small force draws inward. Tension asks so little of our attention. A length of clothesline supports a clean sheet. A braided string suspends a glass prism in a window, and the force within them remains constant and silent. It is simply the line along which a quiet weight comes to rest, asking nothing more than to hold still. You take a rubber band between your fingers and draw it apart. It lengthens, it narrows in the middle, and a soft resistance builds against your hands. That resistance is the spring force, the quiet refusal of certain materials to leave their original shape. Let go, and the band snaps back to a short loop, giving up all the energy you stored in it. That snapback is the defining signature of elastic things. The spring force lives inside a stretched rubber band, a compressed mattress spring, a pulled hair tie. It is the way atoms inside a solid talk to one another. When no force is acting, they sit in a relaxed arrangement, each atom a comfortable distance from its neighbors, held in place by the balance between attraction and repulsion. Give the material a tug, and those atoms shift slightly, widening some gaps and narrowing others. They don't like this new arrangement. The bonds between them strain, and a restoring force appears, pulling them back toward that original state. The harder you pull, the stronger the restoring force grows, as more and more bonds stretch out of their easy positions. This relationship was first measured clearly in the 1660s by the English scientist Robert Hooke. He hung weights from coiled springs and watched how far they elongated. What he found was simple and orderly. Add a small weight, get a small stretch, double the weight, and the spring stretches twice as far. Triple it three times as far. The force pulling on the spring and the distance it moved were directly proportional. A straight line on a graph. Hooke expressed it in Latin, ut tensio sic vis, as the extension, so the force. Today we call it Hooke's law. It holds true not just for coiled metal springs, but for many elastic materials. As long as you don't tug them too hard, the limit matters. There is a point for every springy object beyond, which the atoms don't just strain politely. They slip past one another into new positions. For a paperclip bent too far, the silver-colored metal stays bent. For a rubber band pulled past its limit, it might come back slack and baggy, never quite the same length again. That's the line between elastic behavior, where the object remembers its old shape, and plastic behavior, where it accepts a new one. As long as you stay inside the elastic region, the material is a reliable storehouse for energy. The energy itself is worth noticing. When you stretch a spring or an elastic band, the work your hands do doesn't disappear. It becomes potential energy, tucked into the stretched bonds like a battery that holds only one kind of charge. Release the band, and that potential energy turns into kinetic energy, the energy of motion. The band flies back, the spring recoils, the mattress wire pushes upward. The faster the motion, the more kinetic energy appears. In a perfect, frictionless world, all the potential energy would become kinetic. And then, as the object overshoots a little and compresses, turn back into potential energy in the opposite direction, setting up a gentle oscillation that never dies. Real rubber bands and bedsprings lose some energy to warmth, to the faint internal heating as molecules slide. So the bouncing eventually settles. A mattress spring works in just this gentle, dampened way. When you lie down, your weight compresses dozens of steel coils. Each coil presses back with a force proportional to how much it has been squeezed. Over the course of the night, as you shift position, the springs give and take, storing and releasing energy in small, smooth increments. No single spring ever moves very far. They all stay well within their elastic limits. So the mattress keeps the same shape morning after morning. There's a similar quiet in a stretched rubber band resting on a desk, holding shut a rolled-up newspaper, or looped around a stack of envelopes, the energy sits there patiently, invisible, until you peel the band away, a hair tie, thick with elastic threads wrapped in soft fabric, spends hours stretched around a ponytail without losing its springiness, a wooden bow pulled taut before an arrow is released stores energy in the bent limbs, a trampoline fabric stretched over hundreds of steel springs deforms when someone lands, and then throws them upward again, returning almost all the energy it was given. In each case, the spring force does the same quiet job. Receive a shape change, store it as energy, and then offer it back. The atoms don't learn anything new. They just return to where they were, ready again. A single leaf detaches from a branch overhead and begins its journey toward the ground. It does not plunge. It does not cut a straight line through the air. Instead, it sways from side to side, tilts, lifts for a moment, and then settles lower, tracing a slow, wandering path. Something is holding it back, pressing upward against its flat surface. That something is the air itself. Air feels thin to us, barely there. But it is made of countless molecules in constant motion. When an object tries to fall through it, those molecules must be pushed aside. They push back. The faster the object moves, the more molecules it encounters each second, and the greater that push becomes. This push is air resistance, sometimes called drag. It always acts in the direction opposite to motion, a gentle but persistent break. For a leaf, the effect is pronounced because a leaf has a large surface area compared to its weight. As soon as it starts to fall, air resistance begins to build. At the very first instant, gravity is the only force acting, and the leaf accelerates downward. But within a fraction of a second, the upward force from the air grows. The leaf's speed increases more and more slowly, until the upward force exactly matches the downward pull of gravity. At that moment, the two forces balance perfectly. The leaf no longer accelerates. It continues to fall, but at a steady rate that will not change unless the leaf tilts or folds. That steady rate is called terminal speed. Terminal speed is different for every object. It depends on shape, size, and mass. A flat, broad leaf has a terminal speed low enough that you can watch it drift for long seconds. A drop of water, rounder and denser, falls faster. A pea of hail falls faster still. The principle does not change, only the numbers. For any object falling through a fluid, whether it is air or water, there is a point where resistance balances weight and acceleration ends. A human body in freefall illustrates the same balance on a larger scale. A person stepping out of an aircraft does not experience a continuous rush of increasing speed. After a few seconds, air resistance grows large enough to cancel gravity. In a spread eagle position, with arms and legs out to present the most surface area to the oncoming air, a skydiver reaches a terminal speed of roughly 55 meters per second. The sensation is not one of falling in the stomach-dropping sense, but of resting on a dense cushion of moving air. By changing body shape, pulling the limbs in to become more compact, the skydiver can reduce surface area, raise the terminal speed, and descend faster. Stretching out again slows the descent. The whole descent from that point onward is a quiet equilibrium, a steady drift governed by the same rules that carry the leaf. A maple seed, or samara, adds one more layer to the story. It is shaped like a single wing, with the seed itself as a small, dense weight at one end. When a samara breaks from the tree, it does not tumble or flutter. It begins to spin. The wing catches the air in a way that generates lift, much like the blade of a miniature helicopter, though it is not powered. This spinning motion is called autorotation. As the seed whirls, its wing pushes against the air, and the air pushes back with a vertical component that opposes gravity. The result is a further reduction in descent speed. A maple seed can take several seconds to fall the height of a two-story house, and during those seconds, it may travel a surprising horizontal distance, carried by the slightest breeze. The shape that lets it spin softly also spreads the seeds far from the parent tree. A quiet piece of natural engineering, built entirely on air resistance and lift. The understanding of air resistance began to sharpen in the 17th century, when scientists moved away from the idea that heavier things fall faster simply because they are heavy. Galileo proposed that in a vacuum, where no air is present to resist, all objects, regardless of weight, would accelerate at the same rate and hit the ground together. That idea was later demonstrated dramatically on the moon. But for centuries, people could see that air was the complicating factor. A feather and a coin dropped in a tube from which the air had been pumped fall side by side. With air present, the feather lags because its shape gives it a very low terminal speed. The coin, with its small surface area relative to weight, cuts through the air much more efficiently. Scientists began to measure the drag force systematically, noting that it depends on the density of the fluid, the speed of the object, the cross-sectional area it presents, and a number known as the drag coefficient that captures how streamlined the shape is. A smooth, rounded shape slips through the air with less resistance. A broad, irregular shape meets more. All of it is the same underlying phenomenon. A fluid resists the motion of anything moving through it, and the faster the motion, the stronger the resistance, up to the point of balance. On a still autumn day, you can stand beneath a tree and watch this physics play out in complete silence. Leaves peel away, one by one, and each finds its own path. Some tumble edge over edge. Some rock back and forth like cradles. Some spiral tightly. They all take their time. The air does not merely surround them. It supports them, holding them in a long, soft letting go that ends only when the ground gently stops their motion. Imagine a block of steel, solid and heavy, resting in the palm of your hand. It has a certain weight, a certain dense presence. If you lower that same block into a basin of water, it sinks immediately, straight to the bottom. The steel itself is much denser than water, so gravity pulls it down with force. Now picture a great ocean liner built from thousands of tons of steel, carrying passengers, cargo, fuel, and machinery. It does not plunge to the sea floor. It rests calmly on the surface, rising and falling with the swells. The question is simply what changed. The steel itself remains the same material. The water does not suddenly become thicker or more supportive. The answer lives in the shape and in a principle first understood over 2,000 years ago in the 3rd century before the Common Era. A mathematician named Archimedes lived in the Greek city of Syracuse. One story, passed down through the centuries, describes him stepping into a full bath and noticing the water spill over the sides. He realized that the volume of water that overflowed matched exactly the volume of his own body that entered the tub. This connection between a submerged object and the water it pushes aside became the foundation for understanding why things float. Archimedes captured the idea in a single, quiet truth. Any object, wholly or partly immersed in a fluid, is buoyed up by a force equal to the weight of the fluid displaced by the object. That upward force is buoyancy. Water, like all fluids, presses against everything it touches. The pressure comes from the weight of the water above. Lower down, the pressure is greater higher up, a little less. When a solid object rests in water, the pressure pushing up on its bottom surface turns out to be slightly stronger than the pressure pushing down on its top surface. The difference between them is the buoyant force, and it always points upward. The size of that force depends only on how much water the object pushes out of the way. Displace a small amount of water, and the upward push is light. Displace a large volume, and the upward push grows heavier. A solid steel block displaces only its own volume, which is small for its weight. The weight of that displaced water is far less than the weight of the block. So gravity wins, and it sinks. A ship's hull, by contrast, is mostly empty space. The steel is rolled and welded into a thin, hollow shell that encloses a vast interior filled with air. When the hull settles into the water, it pushes aside an enormous volume of liquid. The weight of all that displaced water is now much greater than it was for the solid block. If the hull is shaped so that the water it displaces weighs more than the entire ship, steel, air, engines, everything, then the upward buoyant force overtakes the downward pull of gravity. The ship rises until the two forces balance, and it floats. This is why a ship's designers speak of displacement tonnage. The number describes the weight of water the hull pushes aside when it sits at its designed waterline. A ship that displaces 50,000 tons of water must weigh slightly less than that when fully loaded, or it will ride too low. Naval architects shape every curve of the hull to spread the displacement evenly, to keep the vessel stable and level. The hollow form is what makes it possible. The steel merely provides a watertight skin around the buoyant volume of air. You can feel a version of this effect with nothing more than a kitchen bowl and a sink of water. An empty metal mixing bowl, placed gently on the surface, floats with ease. Push it straight down, and you sense the water pushing back, resisting, turn the same bowl over so it fills with water and loses its pocket of air, and it sinks without ceremony. The weight of the metal did not change, only the displacement changed. A ship at sea relies on the same gentle balance. It floats not because its materials are light, but because its hollow form asks the water to hold up a weight of displaced liquid that matches its own. As long as that equilibrium holds, the vessel rides softly, supported by the very water it pushes aside. The principle sits there quietly, as it has since Archimedes stepped into his bath. A calm assurance that even the heaviest things can find their place on the surface. A rubber balloon, fresh from a package, has a smooth, slightly powdery surface. It does not seem like an object that could hold itself against a wall without any visible support. Yet after a few seconds of brisk rubbing against a wool sleeve, it will do exactly that. Press it lightly to the wall, and it stays, sometimes for hours, sometimes through the night, clinging with a silent steadiness. The force at work is static electricity, a phenomenon that reveals how tiny imbalances in electric charge can produce a noticeable pull between ordinary objects. The balloon begins electrically neutral. Its rubber surface contains roughly equal numbers of protons, which carry positive charge, and electrons, which carry negative charge. Wool, like many fabrics, also has a balance of charges in its resting state. But when the two materials are rubbed together, the contact is not gentle enough to leave everything in place. Electrons, being far lighter and more mobile than the protons locked inside atomic nuclei, can transfer from one surface to the other. Wool has a greater tendency to lose electrons, while rubber has a greater tendency to gain them. This is not a coincidence. It is a predictable property that scientists have arranged into what is called the triboelectric series. Materials higher on the series tend to give up electrons, and those lower down tend to capture them. Wool sits above rubber, so in the rubbing, electrons migrate from the sleeve into the surface of the balloon. The balloon ends up with a net negative charge. The sleeve is left with a net positive charge, though its effect is often less obvious because the fabric is thicker, and the charge may spread into the surrounding air or into moisture on the skin. The balloon, on the other hand, is a thin insulating membrane. Its newly acquired electrons cannot travel far through the rubber, so they remain crowded on the surface where the rubbing occurred. This is the moment when the balloon becomes capable of clinging. A wall in a typical house is often made of painted drywall, wood paneling, or plaster. None of these are strongly conductive, but they are not perfect insulators either. The atoms and molecules in the wall contain charges that can shift slightly even if they cannot flow freely. When the negatively charged balloon is brought close to the wall, its electric field pushes against the electrons in the wall's surface, nudging them a tiny distance deeper into the material. The wall's surface is left with a slight excess of positive charge, a separation of charges called polarization. The negative balloon and the positively polarized patch of wall attract each other. The attraction is not strong enough to crush the balloon or dent the wall, but it is enough to resist the gentle downward pull of gravity on the lightweight rubber. The balloon remains in place because the force between the separated charges follows a pattern that the French physicist Charles-Augustin de Coulomb described in the 1780s using a delicate torsion balance. Coulomb suspended a small charged sphere on a thin wire and brought another charged sphere near it by measuring how much the wire twisted as the spheres repelled or attracted. He was able to show that the electrostatic force grows stronger as the amount of charge increases and weaker as the distance between the charges increases. Specifically, the force drops off with the square of the distance, having the gap between two charged objects quadruples the pull between them. For the balloon pressed flat against the wall, the distance between the negative charges on the rubber and the induced positive charges on the wall is tiny, maybe a fraction of a millimeter across the microscopic hills and valleys of the two surfaces. That close proximity corresponds to a force strong enough to hold for a long time. What makes the balloon eventually fall is not a sudden change in the law of attraction. Air is slightly conductive due to the ions that naturally drift through it, created by background radiation and other subtle processes. Over time, some of these ions bump into the balloon's surface and slowly carry away the excess electrons. Water vapor in the air speeds this up because water molecules are polar and can latch onto charges, forming tiny conductive paths. In dry indoor air, the balloon may cling for many hours. In humid air, the charge leaks away faster and the balloon drops sooner. There is no sound when it finally releases. The bond simply weakens until the weight of the balloon overcomes it and it drifts to the floor. The same principle shows up in other quiet ways around a home. A sock pulled from a dryer might stick to a shirt for the same reason that the balloon sticks to the wall. Dust settling on a television screen or a computer monitor is drawn by electrostatic attraction. The tiny particles polarized by the charged surface walking across a carpet and then touching a metal doorknob can produce a small spark, which is the sudden equalization of charge between your body and the metal. These events are all expressions of the same force, one that operates without motion or visible linkage, simply because out-of-place electrons create a field that reaches across the space between objects and pulls them gently together. In a quiet room, a balloon on a wall is a demonstration of how balanced the world normally is, and how even a tiny upset in that balance, a few million extra electrons on a rubber surface, can produce a force steady enough to hold a lightweight object in place, silent and still, until the balance slowly restores itself. If you place a bar magnet on a table and lay a sheet of paper over it, then dust the paper with fine iron filings, something quiet and orderly appears. The tiny dark grains, which a moment before scattered at random, now shift and settle into arcs that sweep from one end of the magnet to the other. The lines are not solid threads. They are ephemeral, formed by each filing aligning itself with an invisible influence. This pattern is a map of the magnetic field. A magnetic field is the region around a magnet where a magnetic force can be detected. The field has both strength and direction at every point. The direction is defined by the way a small test magnet, such as a compass needle, would align. By convention, the field lines run from the north pole of the magnet to its south pole outside the magnet, and they continue through the inside to form closed loops. Inside the magnet, they travel from south to north. The lines never cross, and they are most concentrated where the force is strongest, near the poles. Every permanent magnet has two poles, north and south. Bring two north poles close together, and you feel a gentle but definite push apart. A north pole and a south pole, on the other hand, pull toward each other. This push and pull is the hallmark of magnetism. Like poles repel, unlike poles attract. The shape of the field lines reflects this. They curve from north to south, bowing outward, and the density of the lines corresponds to the intensity of the field. A stronger magnet produces a denser bundle of curves. The most familiar magnetic field is the one we stand inside every day. The Earth itself acts as though it contains a large bar magnet, tilted about 11 degrees from its axis of rotation. A compass is simply a small, lightweight magnet free to rotate horizontally. Its north-seeking end points toward the Earth's magnetic south pole, which lies near the geographic north pole. The field lines of the planet run from the southern magnetic region to the northern magnetic region, arcing through the atmosphere. Near the equator, they are almost parallel to the ground. Near the poles, they dive steeply inward. This steady field guided mariners long before anyone understood what caused it. The understanding grew slowly. Lodestones, naturally magnetized chunks of the mineral magnetite, were known to the ancient Greeks and Chinese. By the 12th century, travelers used lodestone slivers floated on water as crude compasses. In 1600, the English physician and scientist William Gilbert published a book that brought precision to the subject. He carved a sphere from a lodestone, which he called a terella, and traced the field around it with a small compass. The pattern he saw on his miniature Earth matched what compasses showed on the full-scale planet. Gilbert concluded correctly that the Earth itself is a giant magnet. Modern permanent magnets are made from alloys of iron, nickel, cobalt, and other elements. Inside these materials, tiny regions called magnetic domains act like miniature magnets. In an unmagnetized piece of iron, the domains point in random directions and cancel one another out. When a strong external field aligns them, the whole piece becomes a magnet. The alignment can be locked in place, creating a permanent magnet that holds its field for decades. The field around such a magnet is a direct result of that collective alignment. A magnetic field can be measured in units of Tesla or Gauss. A typical horseshoe magnet might produce a field of a few hundred Gauss between its poles, while a refrigerator magnet is somewhat weaker. The lines you see in the iron filing picture are not physical things, but representations of the force that would act on a North Pole placed at any spot. The filings simply rotate until they lie along those invisible curves, tracing out a shape that is always there, waiting to be seen. The pattern repeats faithfully around every bar, disc, or horseshoe magnet, whether it is holding a note to a kitchen door or floating a compass card at sea. It is a silent, steady architecture, present and unvarying, through which the poles reach for one another across empty space. Tie a stone to a string and set it swinging in a flat circle. Your hand feels the string tug outward, but the force on the stone itself points inward toward your hand. To keep the stone in its loop, you must pull inward through the string just as firmly as the stone pulls outward on you. That inward pull is the centripetal force. Its name comes from Latin words meaning center-seeking, because at every moment it aims straight toward the center of the circle. Remove the force, let go of the string, and the stone does something simple. It does not fly outward along a curved path. Instead, it moves off in a straight line, tangent to the circle at the point of release. The curve vanishes the instant the inward pull stops. This same arrangement appears any time an object moves along a curved path, a car rounding a bend, a planet tracing its orbit, a swing at the top of its arc. In each case, there is a real physical force pointing toward the center of rotation. The force may be supplied by friction, by gravity, by the tension in a cable, or by the push of a wall, but it always aims inward. What you feel when you are the passenger in that turning car is often described as a centrifugal push, pressing you into the door. That feeling, however, is not a force acting on you from the outside. It is your own body's inertia. Your body, following its preference to move in a straight line, meets the door, which is curving with the car. The door then pushes inward on you, supplying the centripetal force that keeps you turning. Remove the door's inward push. Let the car slide on a surface with no grip, and you would continue straight ahead, not be flung outward. Christian Huygens, the Dutch mathematician and physicist, gave the first precise account of centripetal force in the 1670s, working with pendulum clocks and observing circular motion. He worked out that the inward acceleration needed to keep an object moving at a steady speed in a circle depends on the square of its speed and the radius of the circle. A faster object needs a stronger centripetal push, and a tighter circle also demands more force. If you shorten the string on that stone and twirl it at the same speed, the pull on your hand grows. If you ease your grip and let the radius increase, the force becomes gentler. Huygens' discovery became a basis for Newton's later laws of motion and gave the world a way to understand the orbits of moons and planets. An everyday example sits in a playground on a spinning roundabout. Each rider is kept in a circular path by the seat or the metal bar that pushes inward if a rider shifts closer to the center. The feeling of that push diminishes. The radius is smaller. So even at the same rotation, rate the required inward force lessons. Move outward to the rim and the force grows because the circle is wider. And the same angular speed means a higher linear speed for a car driving around a curve. The centripetal force comes from the friction between the tires and the road. The tires grip sideways, and that sideward grip points toward the center of the turn. On a dry, textured road surface, the friction supplies this inward push reliably. If you steer more sharply, the radius tightens and the needed force rises. The tires adjust their bite accordingly. If you slow down, the force needed drops and the turn feels gentle. Engineers often bank curved roads so that a portion of the car's weight also contributes to the inward push, reducing the reliance on friction alone. The slight tilt of the pavement is a quiet way to help vehicles follow a curved path without extra effort from the driver. Perhaps the most serene example of centripetal force is the orbit of a moon around its planet. Gravity itself becomes the inward pull, arcing a straight line path into an ellipse. There is no string, no friction, no solid push, only the mutual gravitational attraction. The moon is constantly falling toward Earth, in a sense, but its sideways motion is fast enough that it keeps missing, forever tracing a circle. The centripetal force here is gravity, and its magnitude adjusts with distance and speed, just as Huygens' rule describes. In the kitchen, a salad spinner works by the same principle. The bowl is spun, and the inner wall of the basket pushes inward on the lettuce leaves, keeping them moving in a circle. The water droplets, however, are not held as firmly. They are small and slip through the holes, continuing in straight lines once they are no longer contained. The same idea, scaled up, operates in a centrifuge that separates liquids of different density. Though in that quiet context, it does its work without drama. So the force that keeps an object spinning is always inward, always at right angles to the motion, always the reason the object does not stray from its curve. It is present in the slow arc of a thrown ball at its peak, in the hum of a bicycle wheel, in the steady turning of the stars across the night sky. It is a quiet, dependable requirement, one that never ceases until the path becomes straight again. The circle holds only as long as something reaches in toward its center, inside the quiet heart of every atom, far from the gentle wanderings of its electrons. Lies a gathering of particles so small that it would take 100,000 of them placed side by side to span the width of a single atom. This is the nucleus, a knot of protons and neutrons held together by a force that has no equal in the everyday world of pushes and pulls. The challenge is immediate and obvious. Protons carry a positive electric charge, and like charges repel each other with a strength that grows rapidly as they draw near. Inside the cramped quarters of a carbon nucleus, six protons press against one another with an electrical repulsion that would, if left alone, fling them apart in an instant, yet the nucleus remains serenely intact. The reason is a form of binding that has been called, with a quiet aptness, the glue at the heart of matter. The strong nuclear force operates on a scale that defies ordinary intuition. It reaches only across distances of about a quadrillionth of a meter, roughly the width of a proton or neutron itself. Beyond that, it vanishes so completely that an electron circling the nucleus feels nothing of it at all. Within that tiny sphere, however, it acts with an intensity that swamps the electrical repulsion many times over. Protons and neutrons cling to one another as if locked in a close embrace, each nucleon affecting only its immediate neighbors. This short-range quality shapes every atomic nucleus in nature. It is why a helium nucleus, with its two protons, is stable, and why a uranium nucleus, packing many more protons, teeters at the edge of stability after billions of years. The story of how this force was uncovered began with a simple puzzle. Early in the 20th century, Ernest Rutherford fired alpha particles at a thin gold foil and observed that a tiny fraction bounced back sharply. That could only happen if almost all the atom's mass was concentrated in a minuscule central core. The nucleus was discovered, but its composition raised a new question. Once the neutron was identified in 1932, physicists could see that the nucleus contained protons and neutrons in tight proximity. Yet the protons did not fly apart. To explain this, the Japanese theorist Hideki Yukawa proposed in 1935 that nucleons exchange a new kind of particle, one that would carry the strong force between them. He predicted its mass. And a dozen years later, the Pi meson, or pion, was found in cosmic ray experiments, confirming the basic idea. Today, the picture reaches deeper still. We understand that protons and neutrons are themselves built from smaller entities called quarks. And it is between these quarks that the true strong force operates. The carrier of that force, the gluon, binds quarks with an ever-tightening grip, so that isolating one is impossible. What holds the nucleus together is a residual echo of that deeper binding, a kind of nuclear van der Waals force leaking from the insides of protons and neutrons. The strength is still enormous at close range. Removing a single nucleon from a medium-sized nucleus can require millions of electron volts of energy, far more than the chemical bonds that link atoms into molecules. Because the force cares nothing for electric charge, neutrons serve as a kind of extra adhesive. They contribute to the strong attraction without adding to the proton repulsion, which is why larger nuclei contain an increasing proportion of neutrons. The intricate balance between the strong forces pull and the electric repulsions push sets the pattern of stable isotopes that fill our world. The iron in a fleeting breath's oxygen, the calcium in a bone, the carbon in every living cell, all owe their steadfastness to this hidden arrangement. If the atom could be enlarged to the size of a large sports stadium, the nucleus would appear as a small marble at its center, still dense beyond belief. A pinhead containing virtually all the atom's mass, and within that marble, the strong force works silently, binding the pieces with an unseen hand. It is a force that never reaches the skin, never tugs a falling leaf, or guides a compass needle. Yet, without it, there would be no complex atoms, no chemistry, no world of solid things, the quiet permanence of matter, night after night and day after day, rests on this smallest of all glues. The room is dark and still. The blanket rests lightly over you, held down by gravity, which also keeps the bed frame pressed into the carpet. The wooden slats beneath the mattress push upward with a spring force just strong enough to match your weight. In the quiet, a tiny dust mote drifts through a slant of moonlight, its fall slowed to a steady creep by air resistance. Every object within reach sits inside a web of these gentle, balancing pulls and pushes. The lamp on the nightstand is motionless because friction between its base and the wood resists any sideways slide. The water in a glass on the shelf stays level under gravity's steady downward tug. Your own body, warm and heavy, is held in place by tension in the sheets and the buoyant give of the pillow. Surrendering to sleep feels very much like this. A slow release into the net of forces that have been quietly cradling you all along.